I'm Harriet Tramer, and I hope that you will join me when I host Reaching for the Gold on BBS Radio. We will discuss aging and how you, as well as those you love, can navigate your way through your maturing process and even make it an adventure. The show will be broadcast on Tuesday afternoons every other week, right at this time. It should be a chance to learn and also, hopefully, to be entertained. Scott Penwell has quite a story to tell. He went to get medication for his mother, who has a bone degenerative disease and was in considerable pain. Well, what might have been a pretty procedural matter turned out to be more of an adventure than he had anticipated. In fact, government regulations and other problems, plus what might be considered bumbling on the part of some medical professionals, not only forced him to jump through hoops, but also to travel many miles clear across the county. Scott, I never heard of anyone experiencing this frustrations in obtaining medicine. Do you think that travesties of this type are actually rather commonplace, but for whatever reason, nobody wants to discuss them, so you just don't hear about this?
Actually, I think they're becoming more and more prevalent with the focus of the healthcare industry more on profits than perhaps patient outcomes or patient experience, though they do mount the words. I've seen more of this. My mother's been ill for 25 years or so, and over the course of our experience, I have seen it get a little worse. But this was beyond anything I had experienced or heard of in the past.
Tell us what happened.
Well, my mother fell, broke several bones that are rather weak to begin with. Was in the hospital. We took her to the emergency room. They did an x-ray, told her she had cracked one rib, and sent her home. They called us the next day to tell us that maybe we ought to bring her back for pain management because she had broken four ribs and three vertebrae, not cracked one rib. We did that, and she was in the hospital only for pain management. They put a doctor in charge of her case who has no experience writing pain management medications. So, preparing for her release from the hospital, we were given several prescriptions. Prescriptions for this level of drug need to be in writing. They have to be hard copy. They can't be called in, and they have some pretty specific rules. We noticed that one of the prescriptions, which I immediately went to try and fill, wasn't available in the quantities that the prescription was written for. So 24 hours before we needed to take the drugs, we contacted the doctor through the nursing staff and tried to get them to rewrite the prescription. 24 hours later, that hadn't occurred, so I had to track the doctor down to his office in another county. I went to visit him and endured a lecture about how this is very unusual and they don't do this, and with some suspicion that I was about to abuse my mother's medication, they wrote me a new prescription. I took that prescription back into the first county, tried to get it filled, only to find out that they had not included use directions on the prescription. You would think that would be in prescription 101, but I then returned to the doctor's office to have them write another prescription, which this time they wrote in a manner that I could get filled, but it was written with three refills, and there are no refills on that kind of medication. So we had a pain management doctor that didn't know anything about writing prescriptions for pain medication, which I found kind of interesting. That proceeded for a while. We got some more treatment for my mother. We got another doctor in her normal medical group involved. New medication was prescribed, medication that is very unusual, apparently. It took me searching through three counties to find it. I went from one county down to another county to get it filled, which took most of 4 hours or so, and then spent another hour finding out that nobody has that medication, and in order for them to order it, the doctor has to have special certifications and qualifications, which the doctor did not have. You would think they would know that. We managed to find another doctor to speak to who rewrote some things. But again, because these are hard copy, I had to go to another county to pick up new prescriptions. I spent another 4 or 5 hours that day collecting the prescriptions, finding the medications, collecting the medications, and delivering them to my mother. And on the way home from that, the doctor that had prescribed the medication called me to tell me that there had been an error. They had prescribed the wrong version of one of those medications. And so I spent 3 hours the next day collecting another prescription and going again downtown to another county to get it and take it to her. So that's a general idea. I've had some difficulty since with the same medications, but we're at least making progress.
Okay, now let's start from base one. What do you think could be done either on the part of the medical profession or part of the hospital itself to prevent these type of frustrations? Because I'm sure there was frustration not just for you, but for others. How could this be handled more simply? What could be done?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that it's possible given today's system. Today's system is geared towards mass production medicine more than, and you know, we're talking about one of the largest medical clinics in the United States, rated one of the best in the country. So, you know, we're dealing with what we have as the best available today. And I believe as long as the focus is on rapidly moving people through that system to the system's benefit as opposed to the patient's benefit, we're going to continue with this kind of a situation, and I believe it'll become more prevalent. Until we go back to a situation where you have a family doctor who is intimately familiar with you, your past, your health, your family, your situation, and so on. If we have been members of the particular doctor's practice, I am 57 and I've been a member of that practice since I was 12. It has gone through several different doctors. The doctor that is our nominal family doctor was a resident at the time my mother was teaching nursing in the same hospital. So they've known each other a very long time, but he has moved up through the administrative ranks and is now in charge of a health center. He still is nominally our doctor, but I have not seen him, nor has she, throughout several months of this procedure. I really believe that without personal relationships, this is just going to continue.
In other words, if I go to a doctor and I need a very commonly prescribed medication for high blood pressure, I simply work through the system. If it's something that's a little more complicated, snafus like this happen and happen frequently because it's not just working through the system in the way it normally runs.
Through the system instead of having a central figure in charge of the care. There is no central point for communication. Every time, there have been probably five doctors involved in this mess. And every time, the entire explanation and the entire history has to be gone over to explain why we need to do things in a particular way or why we need a particular focus. If we could stick with one point of contact, one person overall in charge of someone's care, which, to my understanding, is the reason that we have a designated physician for the insurance company, so that we have someone who is in charge of her care. That's not how today's system works.
And I think, if anything, we're moving away from that rather than back to it. Because if you go into a hospital, there are people, I believe the proper term is hospitalist, and if you go into hospital, your normal physician may have little to do with your care. It may be the hospitalist. So we are moving in another direction from what you're describing, it would seem to me.
I'm afraid you're correct. I have read an article by the CEO of this particular clinic organization who described in bountiful terms his infatuation with McDonald's. And what I'm seeing is a McDonald's vacation of the medical system.
Now, I interpret the medication you're talking about was pain relief medication. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
Now, we are having more and more circumstances in which people are being cared for at home who may have some serious medical needs. Wouldn't that indicate that situations like what you're describing will be happening more and more often? What if this happened if she had been in the hospital or she had been in a nursing facility? Would have this been simply more routine and handled through the system, or is that incorrect?
Well, no, I believe that's correct. It would not have been more routine. I don't believe there would have been any difference in the steps that took place. I just believe that as consumers, we would not have been aware of them nor have been involved in the experience because the medical clinic itself would have worked out the details in the background. But, you know, because of costs and comfort and desires and independence, you're correct. Many, many people are being taken care of at home. And
now, aging at home is definitely a trend in our country. At least it's popularized. You hear about it every 5 minutes. If I have an elder I'm going to be caring for at home, there is a possibility they may need pain medication. They may need some medication that's not very commonplace in the sense a medication to deal with hypertension would be. What should I know about this if that possibility comes up? Is there anything I can know beforehand that will help me not have to jump through the hoops you did, or is that just simply the way things work?
I am pretty convinced that that is just the way things work. My mother was a professor of nursing for 25 years and has two master's degrees, one in administration. I have been involved in business and responsible for, at one time, 400 people. So we're both very familiar with working through systems and dealing with administrative issues. And if this is what it's like for us, with medical knowledge, with the ability to deal with people and work through a system, what's it like for someone who doesn't have that ability or experience?
What you're bringing up is frightening. I don't know. I certainly have not sat there and counted them, but it sounds like there may be some people who are being cared for at home who do need some type of pain medicine. And it just, because people have to jump through these hoops, which they just may not be in a position to do. I mean, if they tell you to drive to the next county and you have to be at work, what are you going to do?
Correct.
Who may
Absolutely.
Not receive the medication they need?
Well, I believe that to have a complete discussion on this, we also need to add costs. My mother has an outstanding insurance program, and while not wealthy, is at least comfortable. So we are in a position to have some opportunities that perhaps other people in this situation don't have.
Mm.
Without the wherewithal to make this occur, I believe a great many people will, A, be frustrated and not know where to turn or what to do to make the optimal outcome occur, and B, be unable to afford in some cases, even the travel required. I drove hundreds of miles during that particular episode. Fortunately, I have a vehicle in the gas. But think of someone who's trying to take care of their mother and they're working with public transportation, isn't it?
Yeah, it becomes ridiculous. It simply can't happen. And the point should be made, if it can't happen, if this person cannot be cared for at home, they go into a nursing facility, that is considerably more expensive.
And incredibly more expensive.
And if they go on Medicaid, malign somebody who's on Medicaid, then everybody's paying for it. Maybe if some of these things could be a bit more simplified, more people could be cared for at home, be more comfortable long term.
Well, I believe you're correct. I believe we need to examine the term simplified. The clinics do believe they are simplifying things. Unfortunately, they're simplifying these things for themselves. My mother needed a blood test. We arrived at the hospital to get the blood test. The lab was closed for some unannounced reason. So they suggested we go to the emergency room to get the blood drawn. We went to the emergency room and were told we would have to wait for an hour to an hour and a half for a phlebotomist, someone who specializes in drawing blood, to come from the hospital to the emergency room to draw her blood for this test. I guarantee you there were probably 40 more people in that emergency room that could have drawn the blood, but that's not their procedure because they look to make it simple for themselves, not for the customer, not for the client, not for the patient.
Mm-hmm. Not only simple for themselves, but if they have to pay a doctor to draw blood, and it takes,
correct,
I'm just saying this, 10 minutes, they have to,
right,
pay that doctor X amount for that 10 minutes or 15 or whatever it is, as opposed to paying a technician, which would be less.
Correct.
So not
absolutely
only is it,
right,
simplified for them, but financially advantageous.
Correct.
All right, let's take this a step more and how people interact with the system. Obviously, you are a male caregiver. I assume that's happening more and more now. I don't know. I haven't taken an account, but I'm told that's the case. Do you sometimes find people in the system nervous about dealing with a man or not really knowing how to handle it? Is there some discomfort?
Absolutely. Surely. Very often I feel as though I have to be particularly gentle, pay attention to being particularly soft and reserved in order to avoid that kind of a situation. They don't seem to be expecting a male in that situation, and for better or worse, I am slightly more aggressive and direct than I believe they would be looking for. So there are definitely times when it creates an issue, but I must say that there are times when, had I not been forceful, we would not have achieved the outcome we were looking to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of that?
Well, I'd say a fair example is the fact that they wanted to put Mom into rehab, and she did not wish to go there. And the only way we prevented that, because with today's medical system, they believe they know what's best, never mind who they're doing it to. And we told them that we had the experience, we have the ability, we will take her home and rehab her at home. And that took quite a bit of discussion and quite a bit of forceful conversation to make it occur.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're touching upon some things that I think are relevant. Obviously, I'm not a male caregiver, but when my mother was in a nursing home and I was overseeing some of this, oh, you better believe any suggestion I made, like, we are in charge, you are inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Whether I was male, female, anything. I mean, I felt like I was being watched every 2 seconds to make sure that I was not trying to overtake any of their power.
Well, they do seem to have an issue with everything working their way, not your way. Now, in some cases, I'm sure that's important. I'm sure there are many situations where someone is unaware of what's best for them in the health situation, and perhaps it's best that they take that approach. But I believe an individual situation-by-situation approach is probably going to be better in the long run.
Now, let's work this into a more positive vein. Many things you've been saying may be very valid, and if you say they happened, they happened. But I don't want to leave with any negative thoughts. What do you feel you have gained from being a caregiver? How do you think this has been positive? How do you think you have learned and benefited?
Well, I believe that, as in many difficult endeavors in life, it gives us the opportunity to learn more about ourselves and to grow as people. And I have, during the course of the trials and tribulations, learned to be much more patient, learned to understand that some of the people I'm talking to are not the people responsible for the situation. And I have learned the value of a positive mental attitude. I have been aware of that for quite some time, but I must say this has reaffirmed it. Everything in life is a choice. How we choose to feel about a situation, how we choose to react to a situation, largely affects not only the outcome, but how we come through that process. We can either come through gaining positive perspective, as you suggest, or we can become befuddled and confused and beaten.
Not to mention frustrated.
Yes. And I really believe it's important to keep in mind that what we do about a situation and how we feel about a situation is our choice. Perspective is an amazingly powerful tool.
Now, one other point should be made to be perfectly fair and understanding. Our world is changing very rapidly. People are becoming more attuned to their medical care. Sometimes they know what they're talking about. Sometimes they're an authority because they spent 5 minutes reading about it on the internet. Now, they may approach a doctor or a nurse in a nursing home or other situation. Well, I know exactly what needs to be done. Well, they don't.
Well, I would suggest that that's never a good approach, even if you do know what needs to be done. I would say a questioning, collaborative type of an approach. You know, I've read, I've heard, do you think this means, is a much better way to lead someone to a conclusion than to just show up on their turf and usurp their power in their minds.
Well, I understand that, but a lot of people, how can I say, they don't quite understand. We are in a changing world, and they realize they now can ask more questions, and they don't really know how to do it. And healthcare professionals are, you know, in, how can I say, they get into the middle of this. And to be fair, they're in a very difficult situation as much as are the caregivers.
I think you need to expand your point. I think that we are changing so rapidly these days, especially in technology and medical information and breakthroughs and so on, that I find a great majority of the medical community is behind in new advances and understandings and technologies and so forth. So I think that not only are caregivers finding themselves in that situation, medical professionals are as well.
Well, I think sometimes medical professionals know exactly as the name implies, the profession. They know
right.
how to deal with a particular malady. Somebody, I'll say they broke their leg and they're having trouble getting around. Well, they know how to set the leg. The getting around may be something that caregivers between themselves know more about, the day-to-day dealing with the medical issues rather than the emergency or the medical treatment of the issues they may know more about because they're handling them on a day-to-day basis.
Well, correct. And I think over the past probably 20 years or so, when my mother was still teaching, we often had conversations about how people's attitudes had changed. People used to go into medicine because they cared about other people and they wanted to help other people. That was their goal. Now people see it as a reasonably good-paying job with lots of availability, and they go into it as though it's a job. It's not working in a gas station. It's a calling. It's treating other people. It's not... You know, you can. When you work on a car, you can shut it off and come back to it 2 months later, and everything's fine. With a person, you can't exactly shut them off, go home, come back, and find them in the same position tomorrow.
I really think
that there's been a major attitude change.
Now, you talked about how you, as a male, benefit from being a caregiver. Do you think many other men could? Do you think it could be a positive experience and stepping into a new world and a new role and a new understanding for a lot of men?
Well, I would like to think so. I think that no one would choose to step into this if they had the option between this and having an ice cream. But I think if you find yourself in this position, as with any other situation in life, the best thing to do is find a good way to deal with it, to learn from it, to grow, and to work your way through it in a way that gets the outcome that you're looking for. I think that opportunity exists for anybody, male or female. But yes, I believe there are many positive things to gain from the experience for men.
Okay, Scott, thank you very, very much for being a guest. And
well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to have an opportunity to perhaps in some small way help somebody else.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm Harriet Tramer, and I hope that you will join me when I host Reaching for the Gold on BBS Radio. We will discuss aging and how you, as well as those you love, can navigate your way through the maturing process and even make it an adventure. This show will be broadcast on Tuesday afternoons every other week, right at this time. It should be a chance to learn and also to be entertained. Richard Anderson's official title is website and forum administrator for WellSpouse, but his duties often extend much farther than those words might imply, as he helps this group meet its mission of advocating and supporting WellSpouses, people who are caregivers for their marital partners. Richard, tell us a little about your organization.
Okay. Thank you, Harriet, for this opportunity today to talk about the WellSpouse Association. We are a group that whose mission is to offer emotional support to husbands, wives, or partners of people with chronic illness and or long-term disability. And that's a mouthful to say in an elevator speech, but what it boils down to is when you're looking after a wife, a husband, or a partner who's been ill for a long time or disabled, life is very different, and one of the main things that happens before people start looking for help is they feel very alone. The WellSpouse Association exists to give support to spousal caregivers, as these people we are known as, because I was one, and it offers the support in several different ways. Our principal way now is on the internet, because that's becoming a place for many, many people, for most people to go to first of all. But we also have local area support groups, and we have weekend events for respite for spousal caregivers who are members of the association, and also an annual conference.
Now, I'm going to ask what at least appears to me as an obvious question. There are so many, many different support groups out there. Why does somebody whom you call a well spouse need their own group? Why might their needs not be answered simply by going to a support group, for example, for people who are working with someone who has Alzheimer's? Why do they need their own group? What is very specific about this?
Well, that's a very good question, Harriet. And I think in the past, an assumption was made that all family caregivers are the same and that they have similar problems, needs, and also joys, if you want to call it that, in being able to join together with others in a support group. However, what happened when the association was formed, it was formed by a woman named Maggie Strong, who her husband had MS, and she found herself feeling very alone. And yes, she had reached out to the MS groups. And yes, people reach out who are the caregivers, the spousal caregivers, reach out to whatever group their partner or spouse illness suggests they could belong to. Now, I did that myself. And the problem is there's two things going on. First of all, it really is true that disease organizations like the MS Society or the Scleroderma Society, that's what my first wife had, exist for the patient. They're meant to encourage patients. They're meant to help patients. If there's tips available for their care, definitely the caregiver wants to belong or to find out about those. But that is not the reason why the Well Spouse Association came to exist. The reason is really the emotional support. And now we come on to the second part of why this group should exist. Spousal caregivers are not the same as other family caregivers. The spousal caregiver has the intimacy relationship with his or her partner. And that is very different from any other family caregiver. What is going on is that the spousal caregiver loses that intimacy relationship in a lot of little ways. Not completely. Well, yes, sometimes completely. There are still emotional ties, but there is not the really close and special intimacy relationship after you've been living with someone with chronic illness for a number of years. And disease and illness can rob the person, the ill person, of so many of the responses, and in turn, the person who is the partner is not able to feel there's a reciprocity, a real give and take in the intimacy relationship with their partner. And they love them still, and they want to help them. And what happens is, especially spousal caregivers plunge into looking after their wife or husband. And then that becomes their life. And then that can lead to trouble, because if your life is devoted completely to another person, I'm sorry, you're going to reach burnout sometime. And that does happen. A lot of our members are people who realize they were at the end of their rope, and they take the opportunity, they look for somewhere to get help, to join with others who are also in the same boat, so to speak. And it doesn't matter what illness your partner has. There's varying degrees of how sick they are, but what it engenders in the emotional response is an increasing stress on the well caregiver, who wants to do everything they can, but can sometimes themselves get sick. Now, so there's two reasons, in summary, why the association got going. One is the simple fact that family caregivers, whoever they're caring for, cannot get all their needs from a disease organization site. The second reason, as I just described, is the intimacy relationship and how deeply ingrained it is with spousal caregivers, and no one else has that, and that makes us different. And I've just to conclude, I participated in family caregiver groups, and I, along with other spousal caregivers, and I always found, and they found, that yes, it's helpful for tips and tricks about how to care for your ill partner, but no, it's not really possible to talk about what's going on in your marriage, in the intimacy department, in the love department. What happens is most of the people to start with are caring for adult children, adults. They're adults themselves, their children caring for aged parents, or they may be caring for children who are sick. But they do not, and they cannot really, they feel uncomfortable discussing the details of what goes on in a marriage that is facing illness.
Now, one thing that certainly comes to my mind as to how this would be different, if my mother or father is experiencing some ongoing health problems, an aged person, I was born to this person. I didn't choose it. It becomes a real question, particularly if the relationship between me and my parents wasn't good, as to how much I owe them. If you have a spousal situation, you married this person. You promised in sickness or health. Wow. What does that mean? What are your responsibilities? I think that would be very hard issues to deal with when you have your own life.
Yes, it is, Harriet. And one of the things, we don't have exact statistics, but we already know from general statistics taken by the census that around 50% of marriages fail at some point. The people divorce or separate. And there's a rough statistic that I came across, interviews of people who were disabled, how many of them were married and are not now, and it came to something like
7%. Wow.
But nobody's done really detailed research in that area. And so what I'm trying to say is when illness comes into the marriage, there's already strains going on, miscommunication, but partners, and that could become a precipitating factor, and often it is. And the people who are members of our association are actually people who sometimes the illness came even before they got married, but they persevered in the relationship. They cared and have been caring for the other person for many years. In my own case, I was married for 31 years and to my first wife, and she was ill for 29 of those years. So what I'm saying is, yes, the vows are taken. Yes, in a lot of cases, perhaps, probably the majority, where one partner gets sick, it will lead to a divorce. The people that we're helping stayed with their partners. Now, some of them later on get divorced or else separate. Sometimes they separate because their spouse has a dementia or a traumatic brain injury that makes it impossible to live with them, so their partner goes into a nursing home or a long-term rehab or somewhere else. They live apart. That does happen. And what can I say? Everybody starts out wanting to love, honor, cherish, and obey their partner and to care for them in sickness or health. Many are called, but not all succeed.
Okay, now, a few other questions, not to throw you too much of a curve. I hear what you're saying, and I understand the emotions, but there are also often economic factors. Have you ever had cases where somebody had to divorce because that is the only way their spouse's care could be afforded? In other words, if they have their income, the spouse can't get Medicaid or whatever they need. If they don't have their income, they can't. Have you ever had instances where finances became a major, almost overriding issue?
Oh, definitely. And it's like a jigsaw puzzle. Every state does it differently. If you live in the more populous, perhaps richer states like California and New York, you may be able to declare a certain amount of you, the well spouse's income as or community property that you both share as being set aside for you that can't be touched.
Mm-hmm.
But in many other cases, people are bankrupted by the medical bills, by the drug costs for the care of their ill spouse, particularly people who quit their job because they want to care for their partner, but then they don't have a good source of income. So it's a very difficult position for a lot of people. And
I'm sure it's
heartbreaking. Some people actually, according to the laws of their state, do divorce their partner because economically speaking, they would have to declare bankruptcy otherwise.
I'm sure it's very, very difficult. Now, have you had many situations in which you had possibly an older couple, one had Alzheimer's or other serious diseases, the other very much wanted to care for them, but just was not physically able? Have you had that often be a situation you dealt with?
Personally, I haven't had that with friends, I'm trying to think. But it definitely happens, yes, of course. And I think some of our members have that. I just, you know, can't go into the details. But the point is that the person who is caring for the Alzheimer's person, wait a minute, I have a very good personal situation. I can describe my own. My mother was caring for my father who had Alzheimer's, and she reached a point where it was just too difficult. He was getting up a lot during the night, and that would wake her, so she would not get sleep. And so then she eventually had to make the decision to put him in a nursing home. And so, yes, of course, this happens. And people making these decisions, they're not doing it to get rid of the other person. They're doing it because it's the best solution in a very difficult situation. And you will, my mother, for instance, went to the nursing home just about every day and took their service dog as well to visit Dad. And this is what the vast majority of people do.
How would you define a well spouse? Now, the borders may be a little rough. If you have a long-term marriage, there may be times when everyone needs some extra help because of physical or emotional or financial situations where they really need somebody to guide them along and be a support. There are many times in a long-term marriage where somebody has to care for their partner on different levels, emotionally, physically, whatever it is. That is simply part of life, something that's going to happen with a marriage. How is there a distinction, or is there no distinction, between simply the caring for somebody that's part of life and being a well spouse? Is there any line that's crossed where somebody becomes a well spouse?
Okay, Yes, good question. Thank you, Harriet. The thing is, people assume, or hope at least, that any illness can be cured. But it's not true. And what happens with the well spouse is really an individualistic, individual decision. It's not usually a conscious choice, but at some point you realize your husband or wife or partner is not going to get better. And so then it requires a shift in the way you're dealing with the situation. Because what happens in the beginning is people do everything they can to try and work towards a cure, or to make sure that if they can help it, that the diagnosis is of something that can be treated and dealt with and then put aside, and their partner will be well again. Well, if their partner is not well then and continues to have symptoms and new ones develop, you then get into a situation of rolling grief, we call it. You grieve the loss of a particular facility for your partner. Say they were very athletic and they can't do sports anymore. And then you think, okay, I accept this now and we're on a new plateau. And the next thing you know, something else happens that maybe they've lost the ability to write very well. Say they're developing Parkinson's disease or something like that. These illnesses develop in stages, but it's not always clear what stage you're in. And eventually you as the partner and the person closest to them realizes it's not the same as it was before, and then you're grieving it again and then trying to readjust and deal with the new situation, and you're always playing catch up. So that's why I'm talking about rolling grief, and that's how I think that an individual who is a caregiver for their partner, husband or wife, could eventually say to themselves, yes, I am a spousal caregiver. But I'm going to add one more thing. It's really surprising, perhaps to some people, of all family caregivers, spousal caregivers take the longest to recognize that they actually are caregivers and that they will need to look after themselves and take steps to separate themselves from the 24/7 role of caregiver.
Do many of the people
that they,
come into your group, are they in that position that they've been a caregiver for quite a while and don't realize it?
A lot of people. And, well, the people, you see, the thing, what the association is trying to do is to reach out to people who are in the earlier stages of spousal caregiving. But I mean, it took me, I said that I was a caregiver for 29 years till my wife died. Well, I didn't find out about the association until 25 years in. So I went a long time. I knew after about, say, 15 years that I needed to find some kind of support, but I never was able to figure it out really well. Until eventually I looked on the internet and I discovered there's this association that exists.
Well, these things weren't discussed until relatively recently. They just weren't. There were things that happened in the house and stayed in the house. Richard,
That's true, yes.
I thank you very much for being a guest, and I hope that your information will be helpful to our listeners. I'm sure it will. I'm Harriet Tramer, and I hope you will join us when I host Reaching for the Gold on BBS Radio. We will discuss aging and how you, as well as those you love, can navigate your way through your maturing process and even make it an adventure. The show will be broadcast on Tuesday afternoons every other week right at this time. It should be a chance to learn and also to be entertained. I would like to also remind you to look on my website, www.justwannatalk.com. From there, you can go to our Facebook page, and I hope that you will join us there as well as on this show. Thank you very much for listening.